Here we go. Good afternoon. I would like to call the House Transportation Committee to order. Today is Thursday, February 8th. We are in the Barnes Room, Room 124 of the Capitol Building. Let the record reflect that the time is 1:02 p.m. Today we have present Representative Mina, Representative McKay, Representative Vance, and myself, Chair McCabe, and Representative Stutes. The staff assisting us today are Linda Jensen with House Records, Susan Quigley with the LIO, Angela Steffel is my committee aide. Thank you all for your service today. If everyone would please remember to silence their cell phones. Today we have one item on the agenda, one presentation, the Alaska Railroad Investing in Alaska's Future. There's a lot to learn from the Alaska Railroad about capital program, the sewer dock project, locomotive and flat car purchases, grant planning, and of course my favorite, the PMRE and the Northern Rail Extension. And we have 35 slides to get through, so let's get started. I think probably the best bet would be to hold questions until we get pretty far into things and see how much time we have. So in person, we have Mr. Bill O'Leary, CEO and President of the Alaska Railroad, Megan Clemens, Executive Affairs Director, Alaska Railroad. And on Teams, we will eventually have Brian Lindeboud, VP and Chief Engineer, Alaska Railroad, and Clark Hopp, Chief Operating Officer of the Alaska Railroad. So Mr. O'Leary and Ms. Clemens, if you could come to the table and put your name on the record and begin your presentation.
All right. Good afternoon. I'm Megan Clemens, External Affairs Director for the Alaska Railroad.
And good afternoon. There's a password I think that we're going to need to come back into this. afternoon. My name is Bill O'Leary. I'm the President and Chief Executive Officer for the Railroad.
Tell you what, we'll take a brief at ease. Here we go, back on the record.
Well, again, thank you, and thank you very much for the opportunity to be here today. Our goal for the day is to really provide an overview of the Alaska Railroad with really a special emphasis on the investments that we have made in Alaska, investments we are planning to make on Alaska, and really for the good of the railroad and for the economic development of the state. So that's our plan, and certainly we've got between Megan, Brian, and Clark on the phone. I think we should have a group here that should be able to hopefully answer any questions for you. I'm showing you on the screen right now our mission statement, which is really, it's a long mission statement, and can really be boiled down to three words, and that's safety, service, and profitability. And it really is the basis for what we do. It's what drives us. It's how we set our strategic direction. It's how we set our goals out here. I am going to move through these slides relatively quickly because I know this committee is familiar with the railroad at this point. But so, obviously, if I am going too fast, I'm sure somebody will certainly let me know here. This is our quick facts page, which just kind of, if you were looking at one thing about the railroad, a snapshot of it here is this page tells a lot about it. It's just a good reminder. This infrastructure, this critical infrastructure for the state, was completed by the federal government in 1923. And, of course, with railroad math, you see that's where we celebrated our 100th year anniversary last year in 2023. Purchased by the state of Alaska in 1985 and really set up as in a very unique model, one that we think is really a brilliant model, one that really permits the railroad to be successful. So set up as an independent corporation of the state, certainly with ties to the executive branch and the legislative branch, whether it's from the governor appointing our 7-person board of directors, we coming to the legislature for certain activities that are required, a lot of reporting to different groups. But really a model set up to, as I call it, look, smell, taste, and feel similar to private industry, but definitely there for the benefit of the Alaska and the residents of Alaska. So we think the model is a good one. The corporation is, by statute, managed to be self-sustaining, which is really a way of just saying we have to earn our own way. And we do that through our freight, our passenger, and our real estate activities. Commercial activities, we don't come to the legislature asking for money on any kind of a general basis, but we use those funds that we generate from our customers and from other sources and to accomplish that mission and, again, support Alaska businesses and Alaskans. A couple of key points that will be important a little later on. Liabilities of the railroad are their own. By statute, they are not liabilities of the state. There is no recourse to the state. We are shockingly capital intensive, as are all railroads. We've got 600 plus miles of track. You see the other stats there for the number of freight cars, passenger cars, and locomotives, which will be growing here very shortly here. It is up to us to for the care and feeding of those of this infrastructure and those assets. We are a significant employer in the state, you know, normally around 600 people year-round. That swells up to closer to 800 people, our employees, during the summer months when, of course, we're running more of our passenger services and also our construction activities. We are not state employees. We are corporate employees. We do not participate in PERS or any or SBS or anything else of that nature.
Representative Mina has a question.
Thank you, Chair McCabe. Through the chair, on the employees portion, how many full-time employees there are there in this season, like in the summertime? And I'm thinking of the folks who are here on a visa, and are they part of the unions as well?
Through the chair, Representative Mina, so not... We don't directly hire many through the through visa programs. Now, certainly some of the contractors we use on the train, I believe, do related to our food service and janitorial service and things of that nature. But we swell up from about 600 to 800 people during the from the year-round staff to when we ramp up for the construction and heavier passenger season. Like that. And again, majority, I would say, of those summer hires or seasonal staff are members of one of our five unions that we have on the property.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks. Please continue.
Okay. We are heavily unionized, give or take somewhere between 2/3, 3/4 of our staff, as is the norm in the industry. And we're very proud of our veteran hire status in that at least 15% or so of our employees have that status. These are the five strategic goals that we have that are embodied in our strategic plan, board approved at this point. We are actually in the process right now of reworking that plan and kind of updating it. So that's something that we'll be taking some drafts to our board here in the next few months. But it really, boils down to number one is safety. And that's just you cannot run a successful railroad without safety being your primary goal and objective there. So that is something that we take extraordinarily seriously. The next couple relate to the fact that we are mandated to be self-sustaining. And as Megan will get into here in a moment, show you a little bit how the business has been. And capital then is the fourth item. Because you really live and die as a railroad by the amount of capital investment you put into the infrastructure. And then fifth, but certainly not least, is just recognizing the importance of our role in economic development for the state and also the fact about being a good neighbor and working with the many different stakeholders that we have. So I'm going to take a short break for me and ask Megan to, sorry.
That's okay. I can hold it. I forgot. Mr.
Sure.
Chair.
No, thanks. I'd like to recognize that Representative Sumner has joined us at 1:11 and go ahead, Megan. Ms. Clemens, sorry.
Absolutely. All right. Well, as Bill mentioned, those five strategic goals do inform our actions at the railroad and, kind of stands to reason it informs, how we're going to talk about those activities today. So we're going to start off with just a quick overview of safety because it is so important to everything we do at the railroad. Frequently, when we're out making presentations like this, we'll start with kind of a public safety awareness message. You know, people might not recognize the dangers inherent in, you know, being in the rail line and, you know, want to create more awareness around that. We participate in a national program, Operation Lifesaver. So there's certainly that public awareness component. But beyond that, you know, we've implemented the incident-free culture program within the railroad to really emphasize employee safety, contractor safety, and seen real dividends from that program. It's something we think is worthwhile and important and are going to continue to keep pushing on to, you know, make sure safety is paramount in all of our operations. And, you know, of course, the first thing you want to do is prevent any kind of, you know, safety incident happening, but you want to be prepared for, you know, if the worst does come to pass. And so, you know, emergency response training is another thing we take very seriously, plan within the railroad, as well as, you know, with the communities in which we operate, reaching out to those local, you know, emergency responders, going through drills, that sort of training, making sure that we're prepared for any of those scenarios. So after a short overview of safety, took the liberty for the interest of brevity today of sort of combining, you know, the revenue and the profitability, you know, the cost controls to one section here, kind of looking at the financial performance of the Alaska Railroad. And so, you know, we'll start with kind of just an overview of our business lines. And, you know, freight, to kick that off, it's the largest business line for the Alaska Railroad. You know, and it, to that end, gets a great deal of focus within the railroad just because it is so important to our bottom line. And we know it's important to the communities that we operate within as well. So, you know, we're running freight from our docks down in Seward and Whittier, as well as working closely with the Port of Alaska, you know, to bring goods into the state and get them to communities along the rail belt. We're also working with local industry to move commodities and goods within the state to where they need to go. And, you know, the railroad is an important, you know, option for businesses to have. We're not always the right solution, but, you know, for bulk commodities, heavy goods, if you've got a decent timeline, you know, the railroad can be a really helpful option for businesses to, you know, get their goods where they need to go in a very cost efficient and, you know, environmentally sustainable way. You know, and we also do work closely with some of the trucking lines. I think, you know, everybody realizes that hiring has been a challenge. We also know that Alaska's highway system is, you know, has some limitations. And so, you know, we work with the trucking industry, and in some cases it makes sense for them to, you know, put their transload, you know, their cargo onto the train. We can help move it along the rail belt, free up their drivers for other routes where they don't have alternative solutions like that. You know, and help, you know, out with a commercially viable alternative for them for getting their goods where they need to go for their customers. But, you know, we work with partners all across the industry. Currently, we're seeing a big surge due to the North Slope development. So helping to get, you know, big volumes of pipe and frac sand up to support those development projects, you know, work where we can with the energy sector, with the military bases, with the port. Construction, you know, we're always looking for ways to partner with new freight opportunities. You know, not only is it, like I said, our largest business line and then good for our bottom line, but, you know, we think the railroad has a place to help, you know, drive economic benefit through our freight operations for Alaskan communities and industry. And moving on to just a snapshot of our freight operations. So this gives you kind of a, I guess we're up to a 12-year retrospective here on freight operations. You could see, you know, obviously the bar chart starts a little higher over on the left side there. And, you know, one item that, you know, unfortunately is completely eliminated off the chart is export coal. We do still have local coal that we're moving. You know, and gravel fluctuates to a great degree. But, you know, we're seeing some increases in other areas and our interline service, and, you know, in some of these cases, we're looking for ways to, you know, try to be able to accommodate more demand. And I think Bill can speak to that in a couple of slides down here when we'll be talking about some capital investments in new rolling stock to help meet some growing demand. on to our passenger service. This is probably what the Alaska Railroad is most known for. So we do offer a year-round, regularly scheduled passenger rail service. And, you know, I think we heard the other day that we are the only railroad in the country that meets that definition that does not receive state subsidies, state or local. And so, you know, we're very proud of that fact, to be able to operate that passenger service without being an obligation of the state. We're also just really proud to be out and help be an ambassador for Alaska. So, you know, our passenger folks are always going out and, you know, promoting Alaska as a destination, promoting our rail belt communities so that the train can help be a part of bringing, you know, Alaskans and visitors around the state to, you know, get out, explore, spend time in other communities. In part of that, we partner with tour operators, hotels, vendors all across the state so that the railroad is being part of that transportation solution, but then, you know, delivering folks to those local communities where they can stay and, you know, enjoy their time and spend their money, give back to those communities. And, you know, the number at the bottom there is a conservative estimate. I've seen numbers based on average, you know, bus loads, you know, go up as high as 14,000 buses that we're preventing. But somewhere in the, you know, 8,000 to 10,000 to 14,000 motor coaches that might be on Alaska highways in the summer are instead riding the Alaska Railroad. And, you know, full respect to those who prefer, you know, motor coach travel or road trips, but it's nice to give people an option. It's nice to spare the congestion and roadway, you know, wear and tear in the summertime. So, you know, we like to think that's a benefit that the train brings as well. And again, giving you a snapshot of the performance on the passenger side, you can see after, of course, the dramatic dip during the pandemic that we are back stronger than ever. Alaska saw a huge rebound in visitor interest post-pandemic, and we are coming off a record year of passenger ridership, which is really exciting to see. Again, you know, very few people are coming to Alaska solely to ride the railroad. This indicates, you know, strong interest in people visiting Alaska. We know that tourism is a bright spot, and, you know, we're happy that the Alaska Railroad can be a part of helping those visitors get to where they want to go during their time in state. And that brings us around to real estate. So if passenger is our best known, real estate is probably our least known business line. So, you know, you might be aware that at the time of the sale from the federal government to the state of Alaska, that included about 36,000 acres of land along the rail belt. Now, I think it's about 14,000 of that is right of way. About another 2,000 would be operating lands, kind of, you know, rail yards, things like that. And the remaining balance, a little over half of that, would be reserve land that we have available to lease for revenue. Now that we do that at a fair market rate that's, you know, set by an appraisal. But what it allows us to do is stabilize some of that other operating revenue coming from the freight and passenger side, which can be a little bit more prone to fluctuations. And it also, you know, gives us an opportunity to help kind of, you know, look for ways to develop some land around the state in ways that we hope are good, you know, not just for revenue for the Alaska Railroad, but are good for the communities that we're a part of. So, you know, in Anchorage's Ship Creek, of course, that's, you know, our hub and home for the railroad headquarters. But we've been really excited about the Edge development project, you know, putting a new townhomes there. And up in Fairbanks, the Chena Landings project, that was actually an initiative where we realized, you know, those parcels might be appropriate for sale versus lease. Most of the time we go with a lease model, but, you know, we try to look at what's going to be appropriate for the land, appropriate for the community, you know, look for development opportunities that are going to be beneficial for all parties. And on the real estate revenue side, again, here you can see the bulk of that revenue is coming from the lease and permits that I just mentioned. I mean, I should say, while the reserve land, you know, we are leasing that at fair market value, we do also permit for access to the right-of-way or, you know, operating lands as needed. Those permits would be revenue neutral, you know, in almost all cases. That's strictly to cover the cost of administration or, you know, flaggers, whatever might be required, as the case may be. In addition to those reserve lands, we also receive real estate revenue from our docks. So that would be the Whittier Freight Dock, as well as the Seward Freight and the Seward Passenger Dock. And if you're taking a keen look at this slide, you might notice we're missing 2023 on here. That's, you know, just me needing to get the numbers together on the slide. But I can tell you the top line number that we just didn't have it broken out for the bar chart by revenue line. The top line number was just under $30 million this last year. So a pretty substantial jump up from 2022. That was primarily driven by the return of cruising to the Seward passenger dock. So, you know, we expect that to continue to grow into the future, but that would be the explanation for the big jump there. And that brings us to the overall view. So, you know, those business lines that we just discussed, you can see, how those are, making up the piece of the pie. As I said, freight, far and away, the largest business line at almost half of the revenue generated. Passenger coming in just under 20% and real estate just over 10%. The other really important revenue component that we'll be talking about a little bit later would be grants. We're active not only in receiving, formula generated grants, but certainly pursuing competitive grants will they'll be appropriate for railroad projects. We, you know, try to make sure that if there's grant opportunities out there, that we are actively pursuing opportunities to bring those dollars into the state. You can see over on the left side of the bar chart our net income. This is preliminary and unaudited for 2023, but we are projecting a net income of just over $37 million, which, you know, we're really pleased to be in this kind of position. Part of that is, those dollars, we're really happy about generating that because our capital needs are so intensive. So, you know, all of our income is invested directly back into our capital program, and that's not just the maintenance of the infrastructure, which, I mean, the track and bridge, just keeping everything, safe and operational. But, you know, those expenses aren't insignificant, but also looking for opportunities to kind of improve, seek new efficiencies, stay up to date with what's current and standard in lower 48 operations. And just making sure that the railroad is going to be, a viable piece of infrastructure for the state for years to come.
Thanks. Maybe we could pause here. We're doing pretty good on the slides. So I know there's a couple questions. Representative Stutz had a question, and I think Representative Vance had a question. So before we get too far along.
Thank you kindly, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it. Through the chair, on slide 5, I heard you mentioned that the railroad, one of their criteria is to be a good neighbor. Have the issues been resolved in Anchorage? I know that three years ago, there were some real issues with the people and the easements that the railroad was taking right through their property, and that was not a friendly relationship, if I recall, at that time, and I'm wondering if that's been resolved.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Stutz. So I think what you're referring to was an issue between the railroad and a group of homeowners adjacent to the land or adjacent to the rail, especially around the Flying Crown airstrip in South Anchorage. And that was a very contentious issue for the railroad and for the landowners. And it reached a stage where the board of directors of the railroad realized that this was not going to be resolved in a way that in a productive fashion with basically the interactions going on. So what certainly did not take it lightly, the board elected to do what pretty much everybody had said needed to be done and had said this needs to be settled by the courts. So, which, you know, was not something taken lightly by the railroad to actually initiate a quiet title action there. But, you know, everybody you would talk to about this said, well, this looks like a legal issue. And it is. So in, I think it was 2019, a quiet title action was filed in the federal district court. And the result of that was the railroad prevailed in its position on the disagreement. And I would also like to say that, you know, we wanted that for clarity. It was not, you know, something, again, done lightly, because we needed that level of clarity up to the point that the railroad funded the legal fees for the homeowners association. After the federal district court ruled in the railroad's favor, the homeowners association appealed that to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and that decision came back relatively recently. In a 3-0 decision, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals upheld the district court's ruling on that, again agreeing with the railroad's position. So that's where that stands at this particular point. I will say, during the time that was going on, the railroad and the homeowners association renegotiated a permit agreement with a special use land permit with the homeowners association, providing for their use of the land on a into perpetuity, effectively for no cost. So that's I don't know if if your question really is this resolved. We believe it has been. I don't know what the next step may be in the judicial system on this.
Hello, Mr. Chair, please. Thank you. Well, I appreciate hearing that, and I also appreciate the fact that the railroad has reached out to these homeowners and trying to at least accommodate them in some way rather than just kind of running over them, for lack of better terms. Anyway, thank you kindly.
And Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have questions on slide 10, and this is just to help give me a better picture of what your chart's reflecting, so I can understand kind of what was going on in the economy during that time. So do you know why there was such an increase in the gravel in 2017?
Oh, no. Okay. Through the chair, Representative Vance. Yes. If you were to drive up O'Malley Drive in Anchorage in 2017, you would see they filled a valley there, effectively, with the DOT project that to rebuild O'Malley Road and widen it and really turn it into a, I would call it a showpiece road for the most part. And that was the significant amount of gravel that was used on that. And, to that end also, just gravel is one of those things that's very difficult. Our gravel haul from the Matsu Valley into Anchorage is very difficult to predict year over year. It really is dependent upon, the projects that are ready to go, either from the DOT or the airport or the city, the municipality of Anchorage, and also the location of those projects, because in some cases the railroad is more competitive than others. And in that case, O'Malley Road was very competitive for the railroad to be involved, and there was just a lot of gravel.
Follow up,
Representative Vance.
Thank you. My next question is, I see the little red bar has increased significantly in the past couple of years. Can you tell us what other is, since there's obviously been an increase?
Yeah, I had that question for our freight marketing guys when I was putting together this slide as well. What is in other when they pull this report? So other would speak to our trailer on flat car business, as well as the containers that, we take off the port of Alaska and haul up into the interior. It will also capture military moves, kind of, I don't want to say general miscellaneous local freight, but those would be some examples of what would fall into the other category.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Sumner.
So, through the chair, with the sewer dock improvements, are you guys projecting a increase in lease revenue net of debt payments? And if so, what would that amount be?
Through the chair, Representative Sumner. So, as we'll talk to in a little bit here with our sewer dock project, I don't believe there's going to be, as a result of that project, an increase directly in lease revenue at this point. I mean, the current model is that we would lease the or permit the area for a short period of time to the developer for construction activities, but then with the idea that the railroad would then terminate that lease and own the assets. But so nothing material for any extended period of time, if that's your question.
Follow up?
So through the chair, so you, at the completion of the project, you would own the asset and you would then be leasing the asset. Are you anticipating an increased lease revenue at that point of time, or is it going to be approximately the same lease revenue?
Through the chair, Representative Sumner, I believe it'd be the same lease revenue because, yeah, there shouldn't be any change so much in lease revenue. We're anticipating, eventually more passengers coming across, which would be more of a dock revenue as opposed to the lease revenue.
Okay. Representative Stutz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair. How many board members do you have and who appoints those board members?
Through the chair, Representative Stutz, we have 7 board members, and they all serve at the pleasure of the governor.
Thank you.
On we go. Okay.
So Megan has artfully taken us through slide 15 here, but I would just like to reemphasize that banner at the bottom there, that all railroad income goes back into the infrastructure. And that's just really, a key aspect of the whole model. And that explains why we're charged with being self-sustaining to a large degree. Take those monies that after we pay all of our operating expenses and we generate monies that go into our capital program. And which is a fine segue into our capital program here. And you see below on slide 17 here our 5-year capital program. Now, we are statutorily mandated to prepare this, but we would do that anyway because it's just the right thing to be doing to have, a longer term or at least a midterm plan on what our 5-year plan is or what our 5-year capital investment plan is. And, there's so many different metrics you can look at about the railroad as to whether or not we're performing appropriately, efficiently, safely, whatever you want to look at. If you had to choose one, or if I had to choose one metric as to how this railroad is doing, it would be to look at the amount of investment that we are able to make, put back into the railroad. This is a tremendously, as I mentioned earlier, capital-intensive industry we're in. It's not made any easier by the fact we are doing this in Alaska. And you talk to different railroads, other railroads out in the lower 48, and they're sometimes stunned at what the conditions that we will deal with. But all that being said, 5-year plan where we are looking at between our, looking at the funding sources under the blue there, FTA formula monies, as Megan mentioned, are monies that we receive by virtue of the fact we run year-round scheduled passenger service. The CRISI STC grants are grant set-asides, effectively, because Alaska is one of the few states that doesn't have Amtrak service. And then that key number is internally generated funds. And that is, again, what we have left over and available after we pay all of our operating expenses, after we make the match on our competitive grants and on our debt service, or the principal payments on our debt service. And this is the amount that we can put in as the money that has the least restrictions on it, certainly. And then we will, on occasion, use debt, which we're going to talk about here in a moment, our most recent use of that. But you know, the opportunity to be putting in this level of investment back into the plant is something that we've been working towards for a long time. That said, this is not enough. And it's never, or it's not always just, you know, more. But, you know, this railroad came over from federal ownership in, you can't say any other word, but really in just disarray. It was, had not been maintained appropriately. And, you know, the focus of the Alaska Railroad Corporation, which is what became after state transfer, was to make this a safe, efficient railroad. And the way you do that is through smart capital investment. So we use whatever fund sources we can. And this is a six-year, this is a list of the competitive grants that we have gone after and been successful in receiving. And then also the ones we were less than successful in receiving in recent history here. So, you know, through this, we have added 72.7 million dollars worth of competitive grants since the 2018 time frame here for larger capital projects. And, you know, sometimes larger. I mean, larger for us is, you know, you see that $2.5 million one or $1.2 million Whittier Master Plan, up to and including, you know, some $20 million type projects here. And it's a space we play in. It's a space that I think we're actually quite good at. But it is an important thing for us to be able to, you know, augment our regular formula monies and our internal earnings. So what you see on this, on slide 19, is our competitive grant plan for 2024. And, you know, with the infrastructure bill that came out of Washington, D.C. now, a couple years back, there are a number of different programs and opportunities for us to go after. And you see what our, you know, we are still formulating exactly what we're going to do with some of them here. But as you can see, we are planning on playing in the vast majority of the programs out there, from be it FRA, the CRISI grant, to the infra grant, to MARAD, which is, you know, normally port type activities here. But in addition to that, you know, that are supporting the general rail infrastructure that is existing, we are also looking to partner with different stakeholders to move forward on taking advantage of some of these competitive grants. You see the FRA grade crossing elimination program, and there's a couple of parks highway crossings that we think would be could be excellent opportunities for that. So we'll be working with the State Department of Transportation on that. And then I know near and dear to this committee's heart is a discussion about Port McKenzie and the Northern Rail Extension. And as we are, you know, trying to sort through exactly what may make the most sense on that, we are seeing the mega grant program, which assuming Washington, D.C. continues to, you know, fund these programs and technical term gets their act together and passes a budget here sooner more than later. We anticipate the mega grant program coming out in the summer to early fall of 2024. And we think that would be a very opportune program for either or both of the rail extensions that, of course, we talked about the last time. We were asked to speak to, were we planning on competing for the RAISE, in the RAISE program, which is coming out sooner more than later, and we are not. And the reason for that is, just as sort of saying on the slide here, they're all competitive, but this is a very competitive grant program that is deeply oversubscribed, meaning way more applications than there are in funding awarded. And also previous successful applicants have been with a match program in more in the 40 to 50% range, which is significant for, overly significant, we think, for the for the projects that we would be using that for. So we think Mega may be a better bet on that. So continuing on, slide 20. And this is just, sort of snapshot of our basic blocking and tackling, for lack of a better term. It is Super Bowl week here, about bridges and track. And, we have 175 bridges on the Alaska Railroad. And the great news about celebrating our 100th anniversary is we're 100 years old. The not so great news about that is that we have bridges that are either 100 years old or are approaching 100 years old. A lot of them. So, we have taken a significant period of time over the last few years to really put together a full program on this. Brian Lindemuth, our Vice President of Engineering, is on here and could certainly talk at length about, the condition of our bridges. They're all safe. They're all, fine to operate over, but the time has come for in significant rehabilitation of many of them. And also, while we're doing that, to upgrade those to closer to the lower 48 standard, which is going to allow us to move heavier loads and therefore become more efficient per train. So, again, almost out of that, $100-plus million capital budget you saw on the previous slide for 2024, $40 million of that is going to relate to our bridges as well, and we are going to continue to go after competitive grants for some of those bridges. We have been successful in the past with that. Track rehabilitation, again, the same thing. You need to feed the beast here. And it is running a railroad in Alaska is not for the faint of heart. And, we've got a whole lot of ties out there, 2 million plus ties on this railroad that need to be regularly replaced, and as well as the ballast underneath those. And again, we put about minimum of $20 million or so into that program every year. And again, we use our different fund sources for that. We were asked, and I'm showing on slide 21, specifically about a $10 million loan that we have closed on actually last week, not bonds, but actually a bank loan to purchase some additional assets, and just talk a little bit about those and the reason for that. So we have a $10 million loan that is going to be used to fund the purchase of four used SD70 Mack locomotives. And these are our heavy haul, road workhorses. And we have 28 of them currently. We're going to increase the fleet by four. And I'll talk about why here in a second. And additionally, we are going to be increasing the fleet by 30 of our 60-foot flat cars at this point. Now, these flat cars are actually replacements for cars that are after a certain amount of time, the regulators time out. They say your flat cars are timed out. You can't use them anymore, no matter what the condition on them is. And so we're getting a little bit of a jump on that to end up having, while those cars are still in service, we're also going to get the new ones, which is going to give us some increased capacity. And the reason we're doing both of these things is we have experienced a very significant growth over the past few years, primarily almost exclusively related to activity on the North Slope. And between the Pika project and really Willow, certainly not even fully kicking in right now, it is quite amazing how much product we are moving using that interline barge service that we were talking about, where effectively somebody can buy a load of pipe. It can be rolled in Texas or Florida, roll along the lower 48 system up to Seattle, and that rail car with the pipe or whatever the commodity is rolls directly onto a rail barge. Rail barges, our partnership with one of the Linden companies, 8 tracks across, rolls right on there, sails up to Whittier, rolls directly off onto the Alaska Railroad system, and then taken up to Fairbanks, transloaded onto truck and then taken the last couple of hundred miles up to Prudhoe or wherever. And an incredibly efficient, very cost-effective way of doing that, and a very, very capacity constrained at this point, given the amount of product that it needs to move. So what we are doing at this point is we're using other assets we have, including our Seward freight dock, to hopefully take up some of the slack on this or take up some of that need. And so we are bringing a significant service to between Anchorage and Seward now. And as a result of that, we have increased our freight service between Anchorage and Fairbanks from 5 days a week to 6 days a week. And we can do that without a whole lot of issue during the winter months, but during the summer months when every single locomotive is spoken for with our increased passenger service and our increased gravel service, we need additional locomotives. And we will need these flat cars to pull behind the locomotives. So it's a good news story for Alaska. It's a good news story for the Alaska Railroad. And again, it just kind of speaks to continued capital investment here. Other areas of capital investment are we really do love, you know, the old story about, plan the work, work the plan here. So we in Whittier are undergoing an extensive master planning process. We're really looking, and Whittier, again, is where our barge activity comes in, the rail barge. And really, it's, you know, again, very constrained with the mountains on one side, the water on the other here. Are we optimized? Are we best? And how do we plan for the future going forward on this? So this is a work that's been ongoing for the greater part of the last year. We hope to complete it in later summer of 2024. And that's going to then inform our ability to make, wise capital investments. A lot of south end of the railroad, and that's what we call south of Anchorage talk here. And the next couple slides are on Seward. And as I mentioned, or I may have mentioned, maybe if I didn't, I should have mentioned, we own three docks in Seward, a freight dock, a passenger dock, and a, you can call it the old export coal dock or energy dock, whatever you want to call that at this point. But we were fortunate, as you saw earlier in the competitive grant slide, to receive a $20 million grant from the Federal MARAD Association, Maritime Administration, to effectively extend and widen this freight dock to be able to handle more and just be significantly more efficient in our handling of commodities out there. If we could have this done right now, we'd be really happy. We do not have it done right now, and so as a result, we're less than happy. But we are moving forward on this project. We think it's going to be we're going to be modifying the dock. We're going to be modifying some of the uplands to increase again. And before I give Representative Stutes an opportunity to ask the question, I will answer it, that this is the dock that we hope to, if there were, the opportunity to bring the ferry back to Seward, that would be where we would like to explore opportunities for that. And then coming to what I'm going to refer to as a coming attraction here, we have been in front of this committee in the past with regard to our Seward passenger dock project, and we will hopefully be in front of this committee very soon again with regard to our Seward passenger dock project. We have a project, we have a passenger dock that is really one of the two primary gateways for the cruise industry to South Central Alaska and then as a result up into the interior. And the dock that we are using currently for our passenger dock is in no other way, kind way to put it, but in very poor condition. It is past its useful life. We use the term in the past, it's on hospice. Yes, it is still safe. Yes, it is functional, but it's only functional because this year alone, we're going to put over $2 million into this dock just to keep it safe and functional. But we have been working through a number of starts and stops on rebuilding this dock. which is, a critical piece of infrastructure for the visitor industry, really statewide, because it impacts South Central, it impacts Southeast, and it impacts the interior region also. In 2022, we received an authorization from the legislature to issue up to $60 million in debt, tax-exempt debt, to fund this project. As I've spoken with a couple of you earlier today, I think the best description I can come with is that we were trying to fly the plane as we were building it. We were not fully aligned with our customer at that particular point about the scope of what was required at that time. So we continued to work with them, but finally decided to take what we kind of call a strategic pause last March, and said, look, we're just going to work through this process together. We knew it was going to cost more than the bond authorization of $60 million was going to cost, but instead of coming down and requesting something that we weren't confident in, we took that pause, worked with our anchor tenant, who's the Royal Caribbean Group, one of the world's largest, second largest cruise company in the world, to really get the alignment we needed about the scope and the financing and the project itself. And we've done that at this point. And so we are coming back to, we'll be asking this committee shortly to help move a bill along to increase that bond authorization by an incremental $75 million, give or take, $137 million project at this point of investment that will be a marvelous thing for the railroad, the community of Seward, and for the visitor industry in the state. The goal is to build a facility that a new pier and terminal facility that will be in place for the next 50 years and will be able to handle the growth and the larger ships that is planned. The goal is to have this ready to go by 2026, therefore the request this year.
Senator Stutz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair. Well, I'm really happy to hear this because I had heard, you know how rumors start, that the partners, Royal Caribbean, were looking at buying some private property down in Seward and not moving forward with this. And that really alarmed me, number one. So I'm presuming that those issues have been worked out and hopefully. And second of all, with all the construction and everything that is planned on going on, I'm hoping that both between the railroad and Royal Caribbean, they plan on using local hire to do whatever qualified individuals there that are there in Seward to perform this work.
Through the chair, Representative Stutz. Yes. So the threesome, for lack of a better term, here would be Royal Caribbean, the Alaska Railroad, and a developer called the Seward Company that it will be utilizing an Alaskan firm that has extensive experience in dock construction in Alaska.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Vance.
Thank you, through the chair. I appreciate that we previously talked about this, but after seeing this this conceptual photo, it looks very efficient, and it almost looks too efficient. What is the motivation for, based upon this design, for Royal Caribbean to encourage visitors to spend a day or two in Seward before they board the train, or upon return spend a couple of days in Seward before they get back on the vessel, that would stimulate the economy to help the overall Alaskan picture? Because this, by the look of it, they go directly from the vessel to the train to the other destinations that is not circulating those dollars within our Alaskan economy. So that's my concern, is that they wouldn't have much time to go into the community based upon how efficient this design is.
Through the chair, Representative Vance, it's rare we hear that we're being too efficient. I just want to be clear, so I want to make a note of that. But I think when we do, two comments. It's probably a better question to pose to Royal Caribbean, and they will be here, assuming if this bill is, bond bill is, you know, heard in this committee. I can say that Royal Caribbean, I don't want to put words in their mouth, but I'm going to here, and they can correct me if I'm wrong later, and they will, Royal Caribbean is very excited about remaining in Seward. And part of the reasons that they have, told us that, and why they wanted to move forward, even though there were perhaps other, options available to them, is because of the community of Seward, and because of the experience for their guests, either pre or post. So I can't speak to any particular initiatives they may have to do that, but I know it's something that is on their mind about that. And, I think, as we continue to look at asset deployment in the support of this dock, we're looking at trying to, is there a way that we can increase service or change service to provide more options for folks to come down to Seward early if they're, embarking out of Seward, or give them opportunities to do things after. And I think that's, I think as, growth continues out of the south end of the railroad, it's going to be incumbent on all of the communities to make sure that there's a reason to want to be there.
Thank you.
Representative Stutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You're always so kind in indulging me. Representative Vance, that's when, if you heard him mention the ferry, that DOT and Seward were both interested in it too, because if we have the ferry coming in there, when we have tourists coming down, they will have an opportunity then to take the ferry out to rural Alaska and back in, and then hop the train too. So this could be a win-win deal.
Okay, moving on.
Okay, two, the fifth of our strategic pillars here, and that's economic development. And giving a little bit of an update on a couple of projects that we spoke to this committee about back in the November timeframe. And first and foremost here, the Port McKenzie rail extension, and probably don't need to go over exactly what this is, but just very briefly, it is a planned rail extension off the Alaska Railroad main line, coming off somewhere around Houston area and coming down into the Port McKenzie district. And this was a project that was funded by the legislature to the Mat-Su Borough as the project sponsor, culminating in basically a significant portion of the project being completed by about 2015 or so, and roughly $180 million or so of state money into that project. Been laying fallow since, and certainly appears to be, from our perspective, an opportune time, even though there have been efforts made, as you see in the bottom of this slide here. The railroad working with the Mat-Su Borough to go after a grant in 2021. There have been some legislative requests, and we certainly have spoken about the project with our sister entity ADA and some others out there. But right now there is roughly 3 years worth of work left. And if you had the money in hand today, somewhere around $225 million worth of funding needed to move forward and complete this this line. So, there's just, again, 2023 dollars. Based upon some discussions we had in the fall, we went out and really got a hard re-up on the estimate as to what it would take, hiring an engineering firm to do that effort, perform that effort. Again, that $221 million showing right there. And again, if there's any detail we want to really get into, Brian Lindemood, our chief engineer, is online here. So
here's just one second what ADA said. You mentioned, you kind of mentioned them in passing, but I'm interested to know if they were interested, if they're not interested.
In general, I mean, we have had discussions with ADA and really not limiting it just to Port McKenzie, but really talking about rail extensions in general here and how that could support some of the others going on. I mean, the goal is to try to get out of working in a vacuum on this. You know, ADA is doing something over here. The railroad's doing something over here. Let's, you know, again, two great tastes that taste great together here. Let's come together and see if there are some common entities there. So, you know, from my perspective, ADA was supportive and, you know, wanted to help us work through what some of the demand might be for, you know, working for the completion of Port McKenzie.
But no check yet.
Perhaps it's in the mail. I have not checked today.
Representative Stutz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in looking at the map here that you've provided on slide 26, I'm presuming that this freight line or this extension here would be strictly for freight. Am I correct in that presumption?
Through the chair, Representative Stutz, no, not really. I mean, certainly I think the initial thinking was for freight, but the great news about the Alaska Railroad is it's the same track, whether it's freight or it's passenger. Hmm. And so if there was a passenger demand or a need, we would certainly look at that. It's not constrained just to freight.
Thank you.
The Alaska Marine Highway could come right in.
Yeah. We've been through this. Hey, you never know. The more, the merrier.
Perhaps I'm sensing a theme.
You're right.
All right, sir.
Okay. This graph or this chart is it's really not designed to be, you know, anything definitive at this point. It is just more of samples or examples of how funding on this could work, but it does have a cautionary tail to it, in that you'll notice as time goes on that in-service date moves out from given that there's 3 years to complete this, you note the two ones that I think are interesting are that top line that says project cost and the in-service date. And again, we don't know what construction inflation is going to be like. We're looking at the last couple of years or so, and we're just inflating those numbers by that. But it is somewhat staggering to think that, as we continue to move forward, time goes on without this project being done, it is doubtful that it is going to get any cheaper. Let's put it like that. So the green column of state funds was designed with, like, okay, if we were to the railroad or the borough or however the legislature wished to do something like that, were to, you know, fund it, FY 25, 26, and 27. And those are just breakpoints that our engineering group kind of roughly came up with about the kind of work that could be done appropriately over those 3 years and the funding necessary. You are looking at those monies, you know, needing probably, you know, somewhere in the $240 million range. Again, with turnkey by 2027. If, as an example, we were to pursue federal grants and the legislature or some other fund source were able to provide, you know, walking around, give or take 20% for the match on that. And again, that's a sort of breakout between, you know, the $56 million and the $218 million between state and federal in the orange column there. A couple of years later on there, and again, total project cost higher, but the flip side of that is you have some grant funding available to it. So, you know, certainly easier on the general fund. And then the, for lack of a better term, the cranberry column over there, you know, shows that, again, if that some of those monies weren't available until after the 2025 legislative session, so 2026, state year 2026, you would, for that match money, again, the project cost continues to inflate. Again, not to take this as gospel, but it's just really a demonstration or an example of just the impact of this. Sooner is better. And I'll also say, but I realize, you know, I'm not doing you any favors by telling you this, but, you know, state funding is easier than that, but it's also can be certainly more expensive to the state.
You know, we've had a discussion about federalizing the railroad and or federalizing that portion of it or the funding for that. I don't know, I guess, exactly what that means. If it's just we'd have to update the NEPA, thing, or if there's other hurdles or collars and controls that the federal government would put on that section of the rail for their money, or is it just the EPA permit?
And at this particular point, if it's all right with the chair, I would like to phone a friend here and ask our Vice President of Engineering, Brian Lindemood, who's hopefully online, to be able to respond to that.
Sure, Brian's on Teams. So, Mr. Lindemood, can you hear me?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Chair. So the status of the project environmentally at this time is that all federal regulatory permits and so forth have been obtained, and with the exception of the license from the Surface Transportation Board, all those permits have actually been closed out. The remaining work does not need any sort of federal regulatory authority at all. Where this gets complicated is if we introduce federal money to it, whatever federal agency is that would be providing that money, in this case, I'm going to assume it's the Federal Railroad Administration, they would have to do a NEPA environmental analysis for them to take that federal action. And so what would happen is they would pick up the EIS that the Surface Transportation Board did. They would look at it. They would decide if additional work needed to be done. And, you know, in 15 years, there's been a lot of stuff at the federal regulatory environmental side of things that have shifted around. And potentially they would have to go do a supplemental to that EIS to meet their own requirements as they exist today. So as a practical matter, it could delay things up to 2 years just by putting one penny of anybody's federal money into this.
Okay. Representative Vance.
Thank you, through the chair. Just to continue this conversation with legislation that the chair has brought forward, if there was a port authority, a South Central Port Authority that the rail was a part of, would you be eligible for more grants to be able to fulfill some of these requirement matches, you know, federal matches?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, I don't think so. I mean, I don't know, and it would all depend on how the Port Authority was constituted and the like, but at the end of the day, you know, the railroad is still going to need to take care of the railroad's infrastructure. And I mean, and just, you know, our balance sheet is just simply not, you know, of the magnitude that it can address, you know, the kind of money we're talking about here for, you know, a project like this or the Northern Rail Extension. So it would depend on who else is in the Port Authority and what they bring to the table.
Follow up. I think we're at the beginning stages of asking, you know, we're looking for creative opportunities to be able to build the infrastructure, and what's the best way to do that, you know, on to bring it all together and try, I think, inviting others to the table. But what other opportunities for funding are there through partnerships? And I think we're just kind of asking the questions. So I know we're a little off topic, same topic, but as far as the grants go, it's hard to say, but we're just trying to figure out a way to build it. So thank you for that.
Representative Sumner.
Oh, Mr. Chair, perhaps we could sell the railroad to finance this. I don't know.
Might have a bill for that. So one question, probably for Mr. Lindemuth. So if we were to have a combined South Central Port Authority, which would seem to open up at least a portion of the railroad that is right there close to Port McKenzie to a MARAD grant, would it still require an updated federal? I guess you did say if it took 1 cent of federal money, it would need an updated federal EIS and NEPA thing. So, okay.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. Where it would allow MARAD to potentially step in, they step in with all of the with all the hooks that the others do. I would also say that I'm a little, 2 years to me seems like worst case. FRA in particular was a cooperating agency on the original EIS, so they're not walking into this cold, in theory, that any of those folks from 15 years ago are still around. But like I said, the risk is that the amount of stuff that has changed at the federal level that they may have to suddenly go and supplement. And when MARAD is coming in completely cold to this, and I would expect them to take longer no matter what just to get caught up to speed.
Okay, fair point. Thanks.
Well, the last thing I would like to say is just reiterate, I think, a comment we made in the November meeting that, again, I want to be very clear. The railroad is, ready and willing and able to support moving this forward, this project forward, and have no problem with being in the leadership role on it. But as we'll kind of talk about, just to Representative Vance's comment, it really is about partnerships here. Last point on Port McKenzie, that we'll be asking our board of directors to prepare an updated resolution of support for this project at the March board meeting coming up, and I certainly encourage any other groups to do the same. The second of the larger rail extensions we were talking about in the November timeframe is, of course, the Northern Rail Extension. And that is, again, an 80-mile or so extension from our current terminus outside of Fairbanks to the Delta Junction area, crossing over the Tanana River at Salcha and then heading into military training grounds and coming out at Delta Junction. Phase one was completed in the 2014 timeframe. It was a $180+ million project for the longest bridge in Alaska that is over the Tanana at Salcha. And that was funded again through a mix of state monies and military earmarks. And at that, again, similar to Port McKenzie, as given the general economic situation of the state at that point, the funding did dry up at that point, and it's, there's not been a whole lot of progression for it. We do not have as good an estimate on this as we do on Port McKenzie, and part of it is just because there's so much more of this and there's a lot of uncertainty to it. But our, right now, walking around number is in the $1.7 billion range. So, again, not inconsequential on this. So we are, and again, this slide just talks a little bit about what needs to be done on this. And, again, Brian could certainly speak to that if so interested. But I'm going to go directly to the dollars on this. It's a four-phase project, phase one being that bridge that we built on time, on budget, and phase two then is connecting the existing rail line outside of Fairbanks area to that bridge. So to provide, immediate utility for rail transportation across the bridge. Right now it's being used by the military, but not using rail when across the bridge at this point. It is a vehicle or equipment going over it at this particular point. So that is roughly, you know, the next phase, bringing that rail to the bridge and the right of way and the everything else that goes along with the final design and NEPA re-ups and all that other kind of good stuff is a roughly a $200 million project. We have broken that out into a sub-phase, which we think would be something to get the project started, and again, being slightly more bite-sized at the $60 million mark. That number would need some refinement going forward on that, but right now we think that's you know, a reasonable next step if the full $200 million were not available. And then you see the larger numbers of for Phase 3 and Phase 4 up there. Certainly at the time, you know, the military was looked at as the primary user of this. We have engaged, re-engaged with the military at this point and had a characterized a very positive meeting, or rather very productive meeting in the November, December timeframe out at J-Bear. But it's also clear that we need to keep going with that, those discussions with the military. And haven't been as successful in reaching the individuals that we probably need to reach at this point. So, you know, one of the things we will be doing within the next month is making our pilgrimage back to D.C. And with among the things we're going to be talking certainly to the congressional delegation about is perhaps getting their assistance in helping us, you know, find the right place to speak to at the military. And we'll also be meeting with the grant administrators for the mega program and really get a clear understanding of what we think it will take to be successful in that endeavor here.
But so I have two questions. Representative Stutes, three, actually. I have one.
Thank you. Go ahead. No? Oh, you first. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You're always so kind. I just have a quick question. I noticed that on the Northern Extension route, that it requires the purchase of some private land. Is that the case with the Port McKenzie extension as well? Oh, that's good. Thank you. I saw a head shake.
No, you're correct, to the chair, Representative Stutes. The alignment is already, I believe it's the Metsu Borough that had actually secured the alignment for Port McKenzie, but there's no need to purchase or, you know, no private landholders to deal with out there for that one.
Appreciate that and appreciate your indulgence once again, Mr. Chair.
I actually think that right about the time everything dried up on the state was about the time that they had one resistant right-of-way owner that they were pressuring, and then the money dried up, and then whoever the owner was decided to sell. So I don't know how that works, right? Yeah. Representative Vance.
Thank you, through the chair. On the construction cost. Can you help me understand why it's about $22 million per mile for this? Am I understanding that accurately? I mean, that's significant. That's the chunk and change. And I need to kind of wrap my brain around why it's costing that many millions per mile.
Through the chair, Representative Vance, I will start and then I will immediately do what I do best and lateral it over to Brian again at this point. Rail, by its very nature, is very expensive. And there's reasons for that that Brian can talk about. What I will finish with is just to say you're almost always very pleased once you've got it in, but the capital costs and the barriers to entry are significant. That said, if to give the chair to push this to Brian Lindemood for just a quick discussion on some of the cost elements.
Sure. Mr. Lindemood, can you hear? Did you hear the question?
I did, through the chair, Representative Vance. Two primary reasons. Number one, there is a significant amount of permafrost that we're going to have to deal with on the south side of that river, miles of it. And the costs associated with, you know, doing all the extra work that has to be done to get the embankment built and so forth, is significant. And so your cost per you know, your cost per foot goes up several times. The second reason is that there's about 2 miles worth of bridges that need to be built over the Little Delta River, the Delta River, and I don't remember the name of the third one, but there's a third one over there. And, you know, we're talking bridges that are in excess of 1,000 feet a piece. And that's not counting all the little bridges over all the other tributaries that go with it. In comparison, Fort McKenzie, I think the longest bridge on that one's about maybe 120 feet, 130 feet long. And there was, you know, six or seven of them, but they were small, typical construction, nothing special, where these other bridges are going to be significantly special. The third reason is that to build a project of this nature, when we were building Fort McKenzie, we had access, road access, to get into different parts of it, right? You know, some of the road access up around the backside of Big Lake wasn't great, but, you know, we could get in there and, you know, we had access on Miller's Reach Road, Ayrshire Road, and on West of Sitna Highway to access that. In this particular case, we're going to have about 60 miles that there is no access. And so it's going to be a long linear project that's going to require actually a road built next to the railroad to get to the other end, just for the delivery of materials. So you are correct that the cost per mile is significantly more, but the cost to build it, given those challenges, is also directly affecting the cost.
Hello?
One more question, and I'm not sure who might have an answer to this, but how long before we see the return on investment of the $1.7 billion? I know that extending this is significant, but what's the timeline before we start being on the other side of that almost $2 billion?
Your grandchildren's lifetime.
Through the chair, Representative Vance, that's a question I cannot answer. This is a significant infrastructure, economic development, statewide initiative is what this is. And it's I think this would be something that would be very difficult and doesn't necessarily lend itself to a traditional return on investment type of calculation. It's much more so related to putting in infrastructure in a state that is bereft of some basic infrastructure.
I think a lot of that depends on Canada, too. I mean, we're not talking about Canada yet, and I've had some discussions with Canadian MLAs about, you know, hey, if you build it to the border, we'll build our side. And at that point, if that actually comes to fruition, then you're talking pretty quick return on investment because you now have a different option for getting military or goods to and from the lower 48 or natural gas or coal or any of that kind of thing. So, Mr. Lindemood, you forgot to mention Papoose Twins Road. I just wanted to throw that in there because it was fairly well destroyed by the contractor that was putting in the rail spur. So anyway.
You're correct, Mr. Chair. I apologize for skipping that one. It wasn't intentional.
And so this, as we're nearing the end of the presentation at this point, again, it's just talking in generalities about these two projects. And again, very similar to what we talked about in November. Now, these really are economic development type projects for this state, in a state that, again, I think is, you know, has really a lot of significant issues with just basic infrastructure. And so it certainly is not something that we're going to be able to handle on our own, but that is, you know, the reason why I think, you know, we're continuing certainly to talk to the legislature about this. We're also talking to a number of others about this, be it the military. We've had contacts, some preliminary contacts with some industry members, and we're going to continue that outreach with ADA, the congressional delegation, and really just trying to understand how to put together a coalition of stakeholders that understands the benefit that these projects can bring to the state. and the state and its residents here. So again, we stand ready to, you know, do our best to lead the charge on something like this, but just sort of reiterating that we certainly are not going to be able to do this alone.
So maybe I could ask here or this next slide. You're headed to Washington, D.C. You're going to meet with the mega grant folks. How effective would a letter from us, from either the House or the Senate or both, be in begging is the wrong word, but supporting this project, supporting this project and saying that the Alaska legislature and the citizens that we represent are behind the project and we elect you to be our leader.
Yeah, I'm not so sure I'm up for that. Thanks. But I think, Mr. Chairman, you know, I don't know if this is exactly the right time to. I think this is just more of a this meeting next next month will be more of a learning experience for us as and doing to some degree a sales job to the extent we can about hey, you're going to get a grant application and this is what it's going to be all about. My guess is that supporting letter from key stakeholders like such as the legislature and others would be more effective with the actual grant application itself. All that said, you know, one of the things that we really need to come to conclusion about is, you know, this match issue and, you know, the chicken or the egg. Can you put in a grant application without having the source of the match identified, or can we say that, the match is a project and something like that letter that, from key members of the legislature or the executive branch, is supportive and that, not so much trust us, we'll find the match. But somehow, they're going to want to know that if they give us a grant, that match is going to materialize. So that's going to be, this is, I think, I would keep the powder dry at this particular moment, but keep that pen handy.
Sure, well, just let us know when it's appropriate to beg. We're right there. Okay, last slide, I guess. Or second to last, sorry.
Second to last slide, and I'm going to force, unfortunately, poor Megan to talk about this one after not talking for a while.
Sure. Yep, I can pick up for the last one here. Public engagement. So, this kind of goes back to what we spoke about earlier. We really do strive to be a good neighbor. As we celebrated our centennial last year, certainly can recognize that 100 years ago when we put the rail line down, in a lot of areas, communities grew up around the railroad. And perhaps, in some of those communities as they stand today, it might be a little more convenient if the railroad tracks were in a different part of town in some places. This is how things have grown up. And we really do our best to try to maintain our operations in, a safe way that, kind of meets our operational needs and also our, being a good neighbor to our communities, being, kind of minimally disruptive and responsive when we do hear concerns from folks. I think we touch 13 boroughs and municipalities, and we make an effort to be active in all of those communities, whether that's attending, community or city council meetings, participating in chambers, certainly having business contacts just through our various activities, but really just trying to be a part of those communities, responsive to, those needs and concerns as they do arise. I mean, do we get it right every single time? Probably not, but we do make a good faith effort. Just jogging back to the very, one of the very first slides on here, our mission statement is to, support economic development in communities along the rail belt. That's something we take seriously and keep in mind. Beyond that kind of top line level, we're also got a longtime school business partnership. We love hosting community open houses, get to get Alaskans out on some free train rides. Great to see kids coming out on board the train for that. We partner with public lands. I think we're responsible for getting 20% of guests up to Denali National Park. Partner with the Forest Service to get people out to Spencer Glacier off the road system. I think we average about $1 million a year in in-kind charitable donations to organizations, again, all along the rail belt. You know, and of course, also on the economic side, looking for those economic development projects, whether they are on the grand visionary scale of some of these extension projects, or, you know, the Seward Dock project, certainly not necessarily that scale, but still a significant project that's going to, you know, benefit the economy, not just in Seward, but, you know, well beyond the, you know, that'll have impacts down to Southeast, up to the interior. So, you know, just a wide scope of activities, but certainly something we do try to keep top of mind. You know, how do we engage the public? How do we, you know, be a good neighbor in Alaska?
And really, this is the final stage or the final slide. There is no more. So it's just, and this always, I sometimes find myself feeling or coming off sort of self-serving on this, but you know, the railroad is a critical piece of infrastructure in a state that is lacking basic infrastructure. And it's, you know, to Megan's point, do we get everything right all the time? No, we don't. But we, it's not for a lack of trying. It's not for us having our, you know, a clear vision of what we want to do to help this state. And that's really what this organization is about, is supporting Alaskans and Alaskan businesses going forward. So there's always, in any business, there's always a balancing act to be done. And we, you know, try to thread the needle on that appropriately between maintaining what we have and being a good steward of that to also being able to fulfill the other part of our mission, and that is economic development. I think, you know, we are looking to move these economic development projects forward. As we've said, we are looking for stakeholders and partners to join with us on that. But this state is, it's good to have this railroad in this state. And it's something, it's good to have rail in this state. And that being said, appreciate very much your time and attention today. And stand ready if there are any questions we have.
Thanks. Answered. I appreciate it. And I think that Representative McKay would agree with me that I say it all the time, but we can't have resource development if we don't have transportation. And you guys are a big part of that. So I'm hopeful soon in the future to see a 5-year plan, a 10-year plan, a 50-year vision on how the railroad plans to participate, especially in our resource development. You know, I know that coal is flat light right now, but there are clean coal plants coming online all over the world, and frankly, there's going to have to be one in the Matsu somewhere. So we are going to be looking to you, the railroad, and Port McKenzie and possibly other ports to support that. So I'd be very interested to see if I can help publish a plan, a 5-year plan from you, like a business plan, because that's what you are, is business. So I appreciate you being here. It was awesome, as usual. And Ms. Clemens, thank you so much for your participation. Since there's no other item on the agenda today, next week's meetings will include a presentation from DOT, and we'll hear SH-129 and have our second hearing on HB-282. Is that SB-129? Sorry, SB-129. I can't read. That concludes our business today. So seeing no other business, we will adjourn. Let the record reflect that the time is 2:36.